And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Spring is coming sometime, but it's going to be a while. So what good are these winter days? Well, there's no better opportunity to take a look at the trees in your neighborhood as they reveal their beauty and mystery than right now. And as you do, it's a good time to improve your drawing and sketching skills. We share a special secret of the mystery of drawing trees and take a look at the world through the eyes of plants. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One of the first things children draw naturally are trees. You see them popping up in almost every picture they draw. They are the iconic roundish blobs on a stick. And then in later years, as we draw them, we find them a unique challenge. How do you draw a tree? As an artist who loves to draw and paint trees, I'm going to share some of the secrets I've learned. And even if you aren't an artist, I know you'll find some of these mysteries well worth knowing as you head on out into the winter's day, past the frozen limbs of these majestic individuals. You'll see. As we learn the mysteries of drawing trees in segment 2. And since we're already looking so closely at trees, it's a perfect time to see how it would be if we could see the world from a plant's perspective. And that's exactly what we do now in the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and each week we meet to hear some of the world's leading voices challenge us to pay attention to life on Earth. And that certainly is the case with today's guest, author Michael Pollan, as he asks us to see things from a plant's eye view, to consider the possibility that nature isn't opposed to culture, that biochemistry rivals intellect as a survival tool. So now, Michael Pollan.
I want to say a word for the soil and the bees, the plants and the animals, and tell you about a tool, a very simple tool that I have found, although it's really nothing more than a literary conceit, it's not a technology, is very powerful for, I think, changing our relationship to the natural world and to the other species on whom we depend. And that tool is very simply looking at us and the world from the plant's or the animal's point of view. It's not my idea, other people have hit on it, but I've tried to take it to some new places. Let me tell you where I got it. Like a lot of my ideas, like a lot of the tools I use, I found it in the garden. I'm a very devoted gardener, and there was a day about 7 years ago I was planting potatoes. It was the first week of May. This is New England, when the apple trees are just vibrating with bloom. They're just white clouds above. I was here planting my chunks, cutting up potatoes and planting it, and the bees were working on this tree. Bumblebees just making this thing vibrate. And one of the things I really like about gardening is that it doesn't take all your concentration. You really can't get hurt. It's not like woodworking. And you can, you have plenty of kind of mental space for speculation. And the question I asked myself that afternoon in the garden was, working alongside that bumblebee, was what did I and that bumblebee have in common? How was our role in this garden similar and different? And I realized we actually had quite a bit in common. Both of us were disseminating the genes of one species and not another. And both of us, probably, if I can imagine the bee's point of view, thought we were calling the shots. I had decided what kind of potato I wanted to plant. I'd picked my Yukon Gold or Yellowfin or whatever it was. And I had summoned those genes from a seed catalog across the country, brought it, and I was planting it. And that bee, no doubt, assumed that it had decided, I'm going for that apple tree, I'm going for that blossom, I'm going to get the nectar, and I'm going to leave. We have a grammar that suggests that's who we are, that we are sovereign subjects in nature, the bee as well as me. I plant the potatoes, I weed the garden, I domesticate the species. But that day it occurred to me, what if that grammar is nothing more than a self-serving conceit? Because, of course, the bee thinks he's in charge, or she's in charge, but we know better. We know that what's going on between the bee and that flower is that bee has been cleverly manipulated by that flower. And when I say manipulated, I'm talking about in a Darwinian sense, right? I mean, it has evolved a very specific set of traits, color, scent, flavor, pattern, that has lured that bee in. And the bee has been cleverly fooled into taking the nectar and also picking up some powder on its leg and going off to the next blossom. The bee is not calling the shots. And I realized then, I wasn't either. I had been seduced by that potato and not another into planting its, into spreading its genes, giving me a little bit more habitat. And that's when I got the idea, which was, well, what would it be? What would happen if we kind of looked at us from this point of view of these other species who were working on us? And agriculture suddenly appeared to me not as an invention, not as a human technology, but as a coevolutionary development in which a group of very clever species, mostly edible grasses, had exploited us, figured out how to get us to basically deforest the world, the competition of grasses, right? And suddenly everything looked different. And suddenly mowing the lawn that day was a completely different experience. I had thought always, and in fact had written this in my first book, this is a book about gardening, that lawns were nature under culture's boot, that they were totalitarian landscapes, and that when we mowed them, we were cruelly suppressing this species and never letting it set seed or die or have sex. And that's what the lawn was. But then I realized, no, this is exactly what the grasses want us to do. I'm a dupe. I'm a dupe of the lawns, whose goal in life is to outcompete the trees, who it competes with, who they compete with for sunlight. And so by getting us to mow the lawn, we keep the trees from coming back, which in New England happens very, very quickly. So I started looking at things this way and wrote a whole book about it called The Botany of Desire. And I realized that in the same way you can look at a flower and deduce all sorts of interesting things about the taste and the desires of bees, that they like sweetness, that they like this color and not that color, that they like symmetry. What could we find out about ourselves by doing the same thing? That a certain kind of potato, a certain kind of drug, a sativa, indica, cannabis cross has something to say about us, and that wouldn't this be kind of an interesting way to look at the world? Now, the test of any idea, I said it was a literary conceit, is what does it get us? And when you're talking about nature, which is really my subject as a writer, how does it meet the Aldo Leopold test, which is, does it make us better citizens of the biotic community? Get us to do things that leads to the support and perpetuation of the biota rather than its destruction. And I would submit that this idea does this. So let me go through what you gain when you look at the world this way, besides some, you know, entertaining insights about human desire. As an intellectual matter, looking at the world from other species' points of view helps us deal with this weird anomaly, which is intellectual, and this is in the realm of intellectual history. Thanks to Darwin, we figured out we are just one species among many. Evolution's working on us the same way it's working on all the others. We are acted upon as well as acting. We are really in the fiber of the fabric of life. But the weird thing is, we have not absorbed this lesson 150 years later. None of us really believes this. We are still Cartesians, the children of Descartes, who believe that subjectivity, consciousness, sets us apart, that the world is divided into subjects and objects, that there is nature on one side, culture on another. As soon as you start seeing things from the plant's point of view or the animal's point of view, you realize that the real literary conceit is that. Is this the idea that nature is opposed to culture? The idea that that consciousness is everything, and that's another very important thing it does. Looking at the world from other species' points of view is a cure for the disease of human self-importance. You suddenly realize that consciousness, which we value and we consider the crowning achievement of nature, human consciousness, is really just another set of tools for getting along in the world. And it's kind of natural that we would think it was the best tool, but, you know, as there's a comedian who said, well, who's telling me that consciousness is so good and so important? Well, consciousness. So when you look at the plants, you realize that there are other tools, and they're just as interesting. I'll give you two examples. Also from the garden, lima beans. You know what a lima bean does when it's attacked by spider mites? It releases this volatile chemical that goes out into the world and summons another species of mite that comes in and attacks the spider mite defending the lima bean. So what plants have, while we have consciousness, tool making, language, they have biochemistry. And they have perfected that to a degree far beyond we can imagine. And their complexity, their sophistication, is something to really marvel at. And I think it's really the scandal of the Human Genome Project. We went into it thinking 40 or 50,000 human genes, and we came out with only 23,000. Just to give you grounds for comparison, rice, 35,000 genes. So who's the more sophisticated species? Well, we're all equally sophisticated. We've been evolving just as long, just along different paths. So, cure for self-importance, way to sort of make us feel the Darwinian idea. And that's really what I do as a writer, as a storyteller, is try to make people kind of feel what we know and tell stories that actually help us think ecologically. Now, the other use of this is practical. And I'm going to take you to a farm right now. Because I used this idea to develop my understanding of the food system. And what I learned, in fact, is that we are all now being manipulated by corn. And the talk you heard about ethanol earlier today, to me, is the final triumph of corn over good sense. It is part of corn's scheme for world domination. And you will see, the amount of corn planted this year will be up dramatically from last year, and there will be that much more habitat because we've decided ethanol is going to help us. So it helped me understand industrial agriculture, which of course is a Cartesian system. It's based on this idea that we bend other species to our will, and that we are in charge, and that we create these factories, and we have these technological inputs, and we get the food out of it, or the fuel, or whatever we want. Let me take you to a very different kind of farm. This is a farm in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. I went looking for a farm where these ideas about looking at things from the species point of view are actually implemented. And I found it in a man, the farmer's name is Joel Salatin, and I spent a week as an apprentice on his farm. And I took away from this some of the most hopeful news about our relationship to nature that I've ever come across in 25 years of writing about nature. And that is this. The farm is called Polyface. Which means the idea is he's got six different species of animals, as well as some plants, growing in this very elaborate symbiotic arrangement. It's permaculture, those of you know a little bit about this, such that the cows and the pigs and the sheep and the turkeys and the what else does he have? All the six different species, rabbits actually, are all performing ecological services for one another, such that the manure of one is the lunch for the other, and they take care of pests for one another. And I can't, it's a very elaborate and beautiful dance, but I'm going to just give you a close-up on one piece of it. And that is the relationship between his cattle and his chickens, his laying hens. And I'll show you how, if you take this approach, what you get. Okay? And this is a lot more than growing food, as you'll see. This is a different way to think about nature and a way to get away from the zero-sum notion that the Cartesian idea that either nature's winning or we're winning and that for us to get what we want, nature is diminished. So, one day, cattle in a pen. The only technology involved here is this cheap electric fencing relatively new, hooked to a car battery. Even I could carry a quarter-acre paddock, set it up in 15 minutes. Cows graze one day. They move, okay? They graze everything down, intensive grazing. He waits 3 days, and then we towed in something called the Eggmobile. The Eggmobile is a very rickety contraption. It looks like a prairie schooner made out of boards, but it houses 350 chickens. He tows this into the paddock 3 days later and opens the gangplank, turns them down, and 350 hens come streaming down the gangplank, clucking, gossiping as chickens will, and they make a beeline for the cow patties. And what they're doing is very interesting. They're digging through the cow patties for the maggots, the grub, the larva of flies. And the reason he's waited 3 days is because he knows that on the fourth day or the fifth day, those larvae will hatch and he'll have a huge fly problem. But he waits that long to grow them as big and juicy and tasty as he can because they are the chicken's favorite form of protein. So the chickens do their kind of little break dance, and they're pushing around the manure to get at the grubs. And in the process, they're spreading the manure out. Very useful, second ecosystem service. And third, while they're in this paddock, they are, of course, defecating madly. And their very nitrogenous manure is fertilizing this field. They then move out to the next one, and in the course of just a few weeks, the grass just enters this blaze of growth. And within 4 or 5 weeks, he can do it again. He can graze again, he can cut, he can bring in another species, like the lambs, or he can make hay for the winter. Now, I want you to just look really close up onto what's happened there. So it's a very productive system, and what I need to tell you is that on 100 acres, he gets 40,000 pounds of beef, 30,000 pounds of pork, 25,000 dozen eggs, 20,000 broilers, 1,000 turkeys, 1,000 rabbits, an immense amount of food. You know, you hear, can organic feed the world? Well, look how much food you can produce on 100 acres if you do this kind of, again, give each species what it wants, let it realize its desires, its physiological distinctiveness. Put that in play. But look at it from the point of view of the grass now. What happens to the grass when you do this? When a ruminant grazes grass, the grass is cut from this height to this height. And it immediately does something very interesting. Any one of you who gardens knows that there is something called the root-shoot ratio, and plants need to keep the root mass in some rough balance with the leaf mass to be happy. So when they lose a lot of leaf mass, they shed roots. They kind of cauterize them, and the roots die. And the species in the soil go to work basically chewing through those roots, decomposing them, the earthworms, the fungi, the bacteria. And the result is new soil. This is how soil is created. It's created from the bottom up. This is how the prairies were built, the relationship between bison and grasses. And what I realized when I understood this, and if you ask Joel Salatin what he is, he'll tell you he's not a chicken farmer, he's not a sheep farmer, he's not a cattle rancher, he's a grass farmer, because grass is really the keystone species of such a system. Is that, if you think about it, this completely contradicts the tragic idea of nature we hold in our heads, which is that for us to get what we want, nature is diminished. More for us, less for nature. Here, all this food comes off this farm, and at the end of the season, there is actually more soil, more fertility, and more biodiversity. That's a remarkably hopeful thing to do. There are a lot of farmers doing this today. This is well beyond organic agriculture, which is still a Cartesian system, more or less. And what it tells you is that if you begin to take account of other species, take account of the soil, that even with nothing more than this perspectival idea, because there is no technology involved here except for those fences, which could be, you know, they're so cheap, they could be all over Africa in no time, that you can, we can take the food we need from the earth and actually heal the earth in the process. This is a way to reanimate the world. And that's what's so exciting about this perspective. When we really begin to feel Darwin's insights in our bones, the things we can do with nothing more than these ideas are something to be very hopeful about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael Pollan. If you'd like to continue thinking about plants on Earth, you'll enjoy reading his books, which include The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, The Botany of Desire, Second Nature, and A Place of Our Own. And you can visit his website at michaelpollan.com. That's michaelpollan.com. And, as always, thanks to TED.com for making this available. And now I have to warn you, as you head on out into your day, be sure to take a second look at all the plants around you. They just may know more than you think. I'll see you here again next week and every week to bring you a deeper look into the world around us from those who do it best, here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Since we're in the mood to look at life from the perspective of plants, it's time we take a closer look at these plants to understand what they're searching for. We do in just a moment when we learn the mysteries of drawing trees. It's a story you will definitely want to hear. Grab a pencil and paper and get ready as your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
It's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
And now it's time for a real touch with the truth. We're all seeking a way to find it. In just a moment, I'm going to introduce you to one of the most powerful and yet simple ways to literally draw your own conclusions from what you see with your own eyes about life on Earth and the forces and powers that shape us all. That's coming up as we quest into the mystery of drawing trees. It's a show for the artist in all of us, so don't go away. It's easy to take a tree for granted. They are everywhere. Each of us has seen millions and millions of trees. As I put this show together today and I look out my window, I see probably 5,000 trees, and I'm in an urban environment. Trees are one of the first things we learn to draw as young children. They're iconographic. We draw a tube and put an irregular ball on it, and we call it a tree. Look, Mom, I just drew a tree. But I want us to take the time to look more closely at trees. And we will today, as I share with you things I've discovered as I've studied trees to learn to draw and paint them. And hold on just a second for those of you who are about to hit the stop button on your computer. Hold it. Wait. This is more than an art lesson on drawing trees. Because trees, like no other living thing, reveal amazing secrets of life. Things we all want to know. And so I don't care if you think you have no drawing ability or even interest in drawing. This is a show for you and for all the others who really want to know how to draw trees. To follow along, I've created a special drawing trees page, which you should access now from today's show page. You'll find the link between the trees in segment 2. So click on that link now. Okay, you should be on the Drawing Trees page. If you're not, be sure you are. And for those who are, let's move forward. The first thing to notice is that each tree is an individual, just like you and me. And just like us, its unique struggle for life is captured in its body. With a tree, the history becomes permanently enshrined in its form, like no other life forms on Earth. Each tree's existence relies on two main things: a struggle for a place to sink its roots to get food and water, and, very importantly, a struggle to find sunlight to survive. Refer to number 2. Every leaf, twig, branch, and trunk holds a dramatic story for the quest for its place in the sun. Take a close look. You'll be amazed. Therefore, when you draw trees, build that story into your sketch. It will guide your understanding onto the paper. Understand that everything you see was once encoded into a seed. Nature must be, if nothing else, efficient in its design. And this actually makes drawing trees much easier. Here's a secret to drawing trees. Take a look at number 3. Starting with the buds that make leaves, the angle of every leaf, vein, and stem, twig, and branch is the same. Learn to refer to these by referring to time as you'd see it on a clock. A branch will come off another branch at a fixed time angle. Is it a 1 o'clock tree? A 2 o'clock tree? That's how I like to refer to trees when I look at them, or even plants when I'm drawing them. Look at the way in which the angles of the branches come together. Compare them to the hands on a clock. You could be quite precise by saying, it's a 130 tree. Look at the examples and look at trees in your world. You'll see. For example, 3A is a 2 o'clock tree. And you'll notice that that angle is repeated into the upper branches. Of course, what you see is actually the history of the growth of the tree that began with buds and leaves. Take a look at figure 3B. That angle is constant even into the veins of the leaves. That makes it much easier to draw everything about a tree. You start by learning to determine the clock angle. Number 3C shows a 1 o'clock tree. Pictures 3D really show how the angles of those leaves ends up locked into the branches. This uniformity is what makes trees so incredibly beautiful. When you draw them, by simply repeating this angle throughout, you'll feel the life coming into your drawing. You'll see. It's true of all trees. Number 3E shows how the fronds of a palm come off the main trunk, and how that angle is actually the same as the leaves coming off the stem of a frond. Be sure to repeat this throughout whatever tree you draw, and watch as your drawing takes on life. 3F drives home this point, as we see from trunk to branches to leaves, how the angle is always consistent. When you sketch now, think how easy it is to understand this dynamic. I've drawn a lot of trees, and I've become very frustrated because if I try to draw exactly what I see, there's no way in the world I can do that. It's just too complex. It would take far too long. So we end up simplifying. You'll see. When you do, you can use your imagination now to build in the story of the struggle of each branch to find a place to capture sunlight. That can become an interesting artistic exercise. But as well, when you go out now and notice the stories of each tree, you will find some branches which grow this way, but they're blocked by other branches, so the leaves that catch the sunlight lead it in its growth to another place. Those that find sunlight survive, those that don't die. And that directs the growth towards the sun. That's how it works. That quest for a place to catch sunlight in that tree is often a fascinating thing to look for on every single tree. Some trees, particularly the hardwoods like oak, which grow slowly, have a tangled history indeed. You'll see. When you try to identify the clock angle, you will sometimes be confused because it seems as if some limbs come off at a much different angle. Look at number 3G, and when you look carefully, you'll notice that the initial angle of the branch to the tree was consistent, but it then grew downward. That is a beautiful element of the trees as they capture their life in their forms. And for reasons that are not well understood, but are certainly clearly evident when you look at trees' silhouettes, you will notice that tree shapes aren't really rounded. They are instead a combination of straight edges that make their way around the crown to form the shape of the tree. Take a look at number 4. So when you draw a tree, from life or even in your imagination, you might start by drawing these straight guidelines, then draw the tree to fill it in. It will look so much more like a tree than if it was simply rounded. You'll be amazed. And within that shape, be sure to seek a balance amongst all the branches and limbs, the weight, and the distribution, because trees must be balanced to stay standing. Like a skilled dancer, sometimes those contortions can become exhilarating. So finally, I encourage all of you to now go out and make simple drawings of trees or parts of trees with this understanding. I guarantee you that if you practice getting to know a tree, looking into its history revealed in its form, understanding the mystery of the symmetry and rhythm of its branching system, you will be able to go from a sketch that just does not look like life, as we see in the first sketch in number 5, to a tree that feels proud and alive, as we see in the simple yes sketch. And winter is a perfect time to go on out and learn about trees. All you need to do now is to take the time to go on out and get to know a tree. Your life will be forever enriched. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time in the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. We'll meet again next week when your Voice of the Earth celebrates the life we share, here on the Wild Side News.